Good afternoon. Thank you for having me. There are many ways we can influence. Our tools are our voices, our writings, our actions, which may be either public or one-on-one, either high-touch or highly scalable, either face-to-face or online. And there are many groups we can try to influence, such as voters, our co-workers, policymakers. In this talk, I'm particularly interested in how we can influence thought leaders, people who are generally well-informed and highly regarded, at least in their fields of expertise, and who have the podiums or other platforms to share and spread their ideas. When I say thought leaders, I mean people who are themselves in a position to influence. So a better title for this talk might be Earning Influence with Influencers. Influence is highly field-specific, and each of us in this room will have his or her own domain of influence. Fashion, cars, furniture, music, sports, biotech, musical theater, all of these have their own thought leaders and influencers. And for the record, I have no influence at all in any of these areas. My thoughts on and expertise with influence come from my very narrow areas of influence, of interest, primarily entrepreneurship, higher education, economics, and innovation. And so my limited experience in influencing influencers is with influencers in these areas. These might include university administrators, faculty, policymakers, economists, and other entrepreneurs. So given this background and context, let me mention six ways I have found to earn influence with influencers. First, avoid political labels such as progressive, conservative, democratic, or Republican. Many, if not most, of the best social solutions are orthogonal to the conventional political spectrum. Introducing political labels raises people's defenses and adds no clarity to the issues or concerns. For example, allowing people more choice within the modest constraints of protecting life and property is generally a good thing. Is choice a progressive or conservative concept? Some would say both, others would say neither. Whichever may be the case, the labels do nothing to illuminate the issues. Second, be willing to explain your reasoning and be no more certain than your data and reasoning allow. If you're not sure about an assumption, say so. If your reasoning has changed on an issue, say so and why. A question I'm very interested in is, do patents incentivize or discourage innovation? I'm not sure. On the one hand, they enable innovations to be made public without risk of loss of intellectual property. On the other hand, they stifle innovation to the extent that they grant a monopoly on innovations for up to 20 years. There's good data on both sides, and while 20 years may seem excessive, patents of some limited length and breadth would seem to me to promote innovation. It's hard to tell because it's so hard to measure innovation. And I know I'm in this room with some fellow geeks, let me just insert parenthetically something I wouldn't normally get into with most influencers, which is why it's so hard to measure innovation. It's so hard because it means measuring the surface area of an n-dimensional fractal space, where n is the number of human needs that innovations satisfy. Since new innovations can arise between any two adjacent innovations, the innovation surface of human needs space has a fractal quality. Any reduction of this n-dimensional surface to a single scalar measure of innovation, as is usually done, is arbitrary. So be very cautious of popular measures of innovation. Back to my ambivalence about patents. Unfortunately, it appears that there is a virtuous circle, perhaps vicious circle would be more apropos, between patents and regulators, especially the FDA. The longer patents are applicable, the longer the FDA can require clinical trials to reduce or eliminate the agency's risk. This dynamic delays the market introduction of new products and services and stifles innovation. A single death from an allowed drug subjects the FDA to criticism and embarrassment. But as long as a particular drug's use is not allowed or postponed, patients cannot see how their lives are degraded in quality or unnecessarily cut short without access to it. Many of those thousands with life-threatening illnesses whose life a drug could save would, given the choice, very willingly take the drug, even with its known risks. In 1990, Louis Lasagna, chairman of a presidential advisory panel on drug approval, estimated that thousands of lives were being lost each year due to FDA delays in approving and marketing drugs for cancer and AIDS. Indeed, it was public outcry that finally forced the FDA to approve those life-saving drugs. In medical devices, most U.S. startups today that require FDA pre-market approval now sell their products first in Europe, where CE mark compliance is easier and faster to achieve. As a result, Europeans enjoy earlier access to U.S. medical technology than Americans do, and the European medical device industry gains a home field advantage. American consumers and industry all suffer. As another example of this, Amazon just announced that they were testing delivery of by drones, not in the U.S., but in the U.K. At the same time today, ideas can ever more readily piggyback on other ideas, thanks to the internet, social networking, high-speed communications, and transport. So innovations are coming faster, ever faster and faster. Given this, it would seem to me that the period of time that a patent applies should systematically decline by some amount, perhaps 10% every decade. If patents provide IP protection for 20 years today, a decade from now they would do so for 18 years, a decade after that for approximately 16 years, and so on. In my view, this would align patents more closely with the steadily increasing pace of and thus less hamper technological innovation. But again, an obstacle to this approach is the vicious circle between patents and regulators. Pharmaceutical firms would not support a shortening of the life of patents unless they were also accompanied by a shortening of the time required for clinical trials. But to coordinate these two desirable events and make both happen seems very difficult to me. Well, that was a long diversion from my second point, which was explain your reasoning and be no more certain than your data and reasoning allow. My third point would be to think through all of the implications of a policy or recommendation. So much public discourse and debate does not do this. Take, for example, one of the most widely adopted mainstream policies in higher education, admission preferences for underrepresented minorities. This seems like a good idea, doesn't it? It levels the playing field, helps remedy prior discrimination, and enhances diversity on campuses, thus helping redeem the true promise of equal protection. But what are the implications of that policy? Here's a trivial one. If there are underrepresented groups, that necessarily means that there are overrepresented groups. We hear much less about overrepresented than underrepresented groups. The purpose of preferences is to remedy discrimination. We don't like to think that they now cause discrimination in a new way. Most of us would agree that two wrongs don't make a right, but we don't like to think about that second wrong. I recently asked the admissions officer of a major U.S. university how underrepresented is defined. Was it based on admissions, U.S. population, or world population? He couldn't tell me. Asians are generally regarded as overrepresented in higher education. So and yet Asians represent 60% of the world's population. So if representation is based on world population, Asians are not even a minority. They are the majority. They would have to represent more than 60% of a group before they were overrepresented. The right approach is surely not to attempt to correct one wrong, inadequate public schools for minorities, with a second wrong, university preferences for underrepresented groups. The right approach is to focus on the inadequate public schools in the first place. Many new approaches are coming online that both are highly effective and highly scalable, including digital learning, virtual classrooms, and secondary school choice. This is where our focus should be. Fourth, and closely related to this, is to think through and incorporate not just the immediate impact of whatever position you might recommend, but all of the consequences, both intended and unintended. So often we focus on just immediate effects. These are important, of course, but equally or possibly more important are long-term effects. I say possibly more important because longer-term effects often last indefinitely. Here is one example of unintended consequences. The Fed keeps interest rates low to stimulate economic growth. Low interest rates may indeed incentivize borrowing. Whether or not that borrowing is used for investments such as machinery and software, as intended, or for consumption like clothes and travel, is less clear. But lower interest rates also artificially boost the stock market and artificially constrain the returns that on relatively secure and predictable investment vehicles, such as savings bonds and money market accounts. Thus, low rates deny the poor and the elderly, who can't afford the risk of buying stocks, a reasonable return on their savings. If incomes are becoming more unequal, might artificially low interest rates be a contributing factor? Fifth, to influence influencers, provide examples, especially if non-obvious and counterintuitive. For example, to best preserve near-extinct species such as birds and plants, perhaps note that chickens and wheat and soy are in no risk of becoming extinct. Why not? Because they're farmed commercially. Might we do the same to save at-risk species? As another example, we routinely think of and talk about small and medium-sized businesses when we talk about the obstacles that regulations pose to entrepreneurship. But a less visible and less talked about group of businesses are low-income sole proprietors. Often regulations pose even more obstacles to these entrepreneurs because they have so little means in the way of voice and resources to fight back. For example, in over half of the 50 U.S. states, young black women are prohibited from braiding hair without costly licenses. Braiding hair is a simple and safe practice dating back thousands of years, but in some cases, the required irrelevant courses in cosmetology cost thousands of dollars. The very people in society who may find it hardest to provide for themselves and their families and live in self-sufficient dignity are blocked. So provide non-obvious examples that provoke influencers' thoughts. Incidentally, a group that is doing much, very cost-effectively, to help allow young black women to make a living braiding hair is the Institute for Justice, or IJ.org. Please check them out. Finally, seek experiments and do experiments. Traditionally, the social sciences have had to rely on natural experiments. For example, the arbitrary division of common regions and people and imposing different systems of governance, like North and South Korea or East and West Germany. Starting with substantially the same resources as their repressed counterparts, but with much greater freedom, West Germany and South Korea flourished while their counterparts stagnated or regressed. No one would choose to live as people did in the former East Germany or in North Korea today. Another example of natural experiments is the differential timings of the enactment of laws in different jurisdictions, such as Stephen Levitt's correlating reductions in crime with the legalization of abortion 18 years earlier in his book, Freakonomics. In the late 1970s, economics Nobel Prize winner Vernon Smith pioneered deliberate as opposed to natural economic experiments, such as creating mock exchanges to infer the value of traders' place on commodities. More recently, at the MIT Jamil Poverty Action Lab, Esther DeFlo has conducted field experiments to compare the effectiveness of mosquito nets versus vaccines to curb the spread of malaria in Africa. Today, the internet and big data are making deliberate experiments much more readily accessible. My friend Dave Rand, head of the Human Cooperation Laboratory at Yale, has used Amazon Mechanical Turk to compare attitudes towards risk and revenge around the globe. At the MIT Media Lab, Sandy Pentland is doing experiments using social networks and wearable devices to link social interactions with innovation, bubbles, fans, fads, panics, and crashes. He writes about these in his book, Social Physics. Incidentally, some of the most novel work in economics at MIT is being done not in the economics department, but in the media lab, in my view. So we see that economics is increasingly becoming evidence-based, and real-world experiments are becoming increasingly practical and important. These are six ideas for influencing influencers. I welcome your thoughts during the Q&A and the breaks. Thank you.